Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to a recording about Kimberly, a contestant at Starmania 2008. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for questions 1 to 9. Put a cross in the correct box. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Hi, I'm Kimberly, and I'm going to tell you a bit about my Starmania experiences. I was a contestant at Starmania 2008. Well, first, about the audition. I heard of the audition from friends and from family, and they all told me to go there, but I wasn't really motivated. But then I went there, just for fun. And the audition was a great experience. I wasn't really satisfied, and the judges were very strict, but I got further, and I improved at every round, and then the third round, the semi-finalists were all taken to Vienna, even the ones from far away, so they had a three-hour drive, and they all came to Vienna, and then the judges personally told each and everyone if they're in the show or not. So the poor guys who weren't in the show, they had to drive 4 hours back home just to find out that they're not in the show. But I made it into the show, and of course I was really excited to know that I'm going to make such a great experience. Before the show aired, all the Starmaniacs were introduced to the contract, and we were all very shocked because it seemed like we were going to sell our soul to the devil. It was a stack of 200 pages, what we can do, what we shouldn't do, what we have to do. For example, we weren't allowed to ski or do any sport during the time frame where the show was because, you know, nothing's supposed to happen to us. Now, we got, during the time frame of the show, we got our hotels and all for ourselves, and all the costs for food, for example, or transportation were paid for. So it was very nice, actually. They really cared about us. At the hotel, for example, I had so many nice experiences, but also very new experiences. For example, there were even photographs taken when I came out of my hotel in my pajamas, and you're, of course, not, you know, you don't expect something like that, and they always watched out if we were doing bad things and see where we go out, just to see if they can get something in the media. The week itself always began with a selection of our song, and then work started. It was very hard work. We started at 7 a.m., including voice training, choreography, interviews, photo shoots, autograph sessions, and this went on the whole day until about midnight. One day before the show, we always had our stage practice, where also people could watch. And after that, we had our last and our biggest autograph session, where even I saw people crying because they were so desperate to get our autographs. So it was definitely a new experience for all of us. But anyway, so after our stage practice, our last run-throughs were actually 2 hours before the show. And then we got our makeup done and our costumes ready, and the show was ready to start. I, of course, like probably all other contestants, was very nervous in before the performance. But I think that's normal. It wouldn't really be normal if not. That's just part of it. But I myself, as soon as I'm on the stage, as soon as I sing my first word, it's all gone. And I just enjoy my performance. Now my life is actually still pretty exciting. You know, I still keep going with this business because it's always been my interest. But also from the show, people recognize me on the streets, which is so exciting and absolutely something new. And they also ask for my autographs. And in school, the kids line up in front of my classroom around the corner and for meters and meters just to have my autograph. And it's very exciting and it really honors me. I'm very glad to have made that experience. Hi, I'm Kimberly, and I'm going to tell you a bit about my Starmania experiences. I was a contestant at Starmania 2008. Well, first, about the audition. I heard of the audition from friends and from family, and they all told me to go there, but I wasn't really motivated. But then I went there, just for fun. And the audition was a great experience. I wasn't really satisfied, and the judges were very strict, but I got further, and I improved at every round, and then the third round, the semi-finalists were all taken to Vienna, even the ones from far away, so they had a three-hour drive, and they all came to Vienna, and then the judges personally told each and everyone if they're in the show or not. So the poor guys who weren't in the show, they had to drive 4 hours back home just to find out that they're not in the show. But I made it into the show, and of course I was really excited to know that I'm going to make such a great experience. Before the show aired, all the Starmaniacs were introduced to the contract, and we were all very shocked because it seemed like we were going to sell our soul to the devil. It was a stack of 200 pages, what we can do, what we shouldn't do, what we have to do. For example, we weren't allowed to ski or do any sport during the time frame where the show was because, you know, nothing's supposed to happen to us. Now, we got, during the time frame of the show, we got our hotels and all for ourselves, and all the costs for food, for example, or transportation were paid for. So it was very nice, actually. They really cared about us. At the hotel, for example, I had so many nice experiences, but also very new experiences. For example, there were even photographs taken when I came out of my hotel in my pajamas, and you're, of course, not, you know, you don't expect something like that, and they always watched out if we were doing bad things and see where we go out, just to see if they can get something in the media. The week itself always began with a selection of our song, and then work started. It was very hard work. We started at 7 a.m., including voice training, choreography, interviews, photo shoots, autograph sessions, and this went on the whole day until about midnight. One day before the show, we always had our stage practice, where also people could watch. And after that, we had our last and our biggest autograph session, where even I saw people crying because they were so desperate to get our autographs. So it was definitely a new experience for all of us. But anyway, so after our stage practice, our last run-throughs were actually 2 hours before the show. And then we got our makeup done and our costumes ready, and the show was ready to start. I, of course, like probably all other contestants, was very nervous in before the performance. But I think that's normal. It wouldn't really be normal if not. That's just part of it. But I myself, as soon as I'm on the stage, as soon as I sing my first word, it's all gone. And I just enjoy my performance. Now my life is actually still pretty exciting. You know, I still keep going with this business because it's always been my interest. But also from the show, people recognize me on the streets, which is so exciting and absolutely something new. And they also ask for my autographs. And in school, the kids line up in front of my classroom around the corner and for meters or meters just to have my autograph. And it's very exciting and it really honors me. I'm very glad to have made that experience.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a recording about the famous musician Brian Eno's views on singing. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 10 to 16 with the sentence endings A to I. There is one sentence ending that you should not use. The first one, zero, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
We recorded Brian Eno on a recent Tuesday evening in a London flat where he keeps his recording studio. He read his essay just before about 15 guests showed up, as they do every week. Once they arrived, they all stood around a table for a few hours and sang. Here's Brian Eno with his essay for This I Believe.
I believe in singing. I believe in singing together. A few years ago, a friend and I realized that we both loved singing, but we didn't do much of it. So we started a weekly a cappella group with just four members. After a year, we started inviting other people to join. We didn't insist on musical experience. In fact, some of our members had never sung before. Now the group has ballooned to around 15, 20 people. I believe that singing is the key to long life, a good figure, a stable temperament, increased intelligence, new friends, super self-confidence, heightened sexual attractiveness, and a better sense of humour. A recent long-term study conducted in Scandinavia sought to discover which activities related to a healthy and happy later life. Three stood out: camping, dancing, and singing. Well, there are physiological benefits, obviously. You use your lungs in a way that you probably wouldn't for the rest of the day, breathing deeply and openly. And there are psychological benefits, too. Singing aloud leaves you with a sense of levity and contentedness. And then there are what I'd call civilizational benefits. When you sing with a group of people, you learn how to subsume yourself into a group consciousness, because a cappella singing is all about the immersion of the self into the community. That's one of the great feelings, to stop being me for a little while and to become us. That way lies empathy, the great social virtue. Well, here's what we do in an evening. We get some drinks, some snacks, some sheets of lyrics, and a strict starting time. We warm up a bit first. The critical thing turns out to be the choice of songs. The songs that seem to work best are those based around the basic chords of blues and rock and country music. You want songs that are word-rich and also vowel-rich, because it's on the long vowel sounds of a song such as Bring It On Home To Me. You know I'll always be your slave. That's where your harmonies really express themselves. And when you get a lot of people singing a harmony on a long note like that, it's beautiful. But singing isn't only about harmonizing pitch like that. It has two other dimensions. The first one is rhythm. It's thrilling when you get the rhythm of something right and you all do a complicated rhythm together. Oh, when them cotton ball get a rotten, you can't pick very much cotton. So when 16 or 20 people get that dead right together at a fast tempo, that's very impressive. But the other thing that you have to harmonise, besides pitch and rhythm, is tone. To be able to hit exactly the same vowel sound at a number of different pitches seems unsurprising in concept, but is beautiful when it happens. So I believe in singing to such an extent that if I were asked to redesign the British educational system, I'd start by insisting that group singing becomes a central part of the daily routine. I believe it builds character and, more than anything else, encourages a taste for cooperation with others. This seems to be about the most important thing a school could do for you.
Brian Eno with his essay for This I Believe. For a list of songs Eno recommends for group singing, visit npr.org/thisibelieve, where you'll also find information on submitting your own essay to our series. For This I Believe, I'm Jay Allison. We recorded Brian Eno on a recent Tuesday evening in a London flat where he keeps his recording studio. He read his essay just before about 15 guests showed up, as they do every week. Once they arrived, they all stood around a table for a few hours and sang. Here's Brian Eno with his essay for This I Believe.
I believe in singing. I believe in singing together. A few years ago, a friend and I realized that we both loved singing, but we didn't do much of it. So we started a weekly a cappella group with just four members. After a year, we started inviting other people to join. We didn't insist on musical experience. In fact, some of our members had never sung before. Now the group has ballooned to around 15, 20 people. I believe that singing is the key to long life, a good figure, a stable temperament, increased intelligence, new friends, super self-confidence, heightened sexual attractiveness, and a better sense of humour. A recent long-term study conducted in Scandinavia sought to discover which activities related to a healthy and happy later life. Three stood out: camping, dancing, and singing. Well, there are physiological benefits, obviously. You use your lungs in a way that you probably wouldn't for the rest of the day, breathing deeply and openly. And there are psychological benefits, too. Singing aloud leaves you with a sense of levity and contentedness. And then there are what I'd call civilizational benefits. When you sing with a group of people, you learn how to subsume yourself into a group consciousness, because a cappella singing is all about the immersion of the self into the community. That's one of the great feelings, to stop being me for a little while and to become us. That way lies empathy, the great social virtue. Well, here's what we do in an evening. We get some drinks, some snacks, some sheets of lyrics, and a strict starting time. We warm up a bit first. The critical thing turns out to be the choice of songs. The songs that seem to work best are those based around the basic chords of blues and rock and country music. You want songs that are word-rich and also vowel-rich, because it's on the long vowel sounds of a song such as Bring It On Home to Me. You know I'll always be your slave. That's where your harmonies really express themselves, and when you get a lot of people singing a harmony on a long note like that, it's beautiful. But singing isn't only about harmonizing pitch like that. It has two other dimensions. The first one is rhythm. It's thrilling when you get the rhythm of something right and you all do a complicated rhythm together. Oh, when them cotton balls get a rotten, you can't pick very much cotton. So when 16 or 20 people get that dead right together at a fast tempo, that's very impressive. But the other thing that you have to harmonize, besides pitch and rhythm, is tone. To be able to hit exactly the same vowel sound at a number of different pitches seems unsurprising in concept, but is beautiful when it happens. So I believe in singing to such an extent that if I were asked to redesign the British educational system, I'd start by insisting that group singing becomes a central part of the daily routine. I believe it builds character, and more than anything else, encourages a taste for cooperation with others. This seems to be about the most important thing a school could do for you.
Brian Eno with his essay for This I Believe. For a list of songs Eno recommends for group singing, visit npr.org/thisibelieve, where you'll also find information on submitting your own essay to our series. For This I Believe, I'm Jay Allison.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a recording about gladiators. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below, then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 17 to 26 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
This is the problem. Take a pair of scales of...
For most people, the word gladiator brings to mind either Russell Crowe as Maximus or Kirk Douglas as Spartacus. And so most of us believe that gladiators were prisoners of war or criminals who were on the road continuously fighting in wild free-for-all melees. And most of us think that all gladiator bouts finished with at least one of them dying. Now, these beliefs have, like all successful myths, some nuggets of truth. But they are basically wrong. The word gladiator means swordsman in Latin, and it comes from gladius, which means sword. At the very beginning, the gladiators fought to the death at Etruscan funerals to be bodyguards for the deceased person in the next world. Later on, Roman entrepreneurs recognized an opportunity and changed the emphasis from furnishing funeral attendance to providing entertainment. And so, gladiatorial fixtures took off in Rome and spread throughout the empire. The first documented gladiator bout in 264 BC had just three pairs of gladiators. But 3.5 centuries later, in 107 AD, the Emperor Trajan celebrated a triumph with 5,000 pairs of gladiators in the arena. 50,000 people would crowd into the Colosseum to enjoy the sport, junk food, and merchandise. Yes, the spectators could buy special souvenir glass cups embossed with the names of their favourite gladiators. Gladiatorial bouts finished early in the 5th century for a few reasons, including the opposition of Christians and the great costs involved. In the gladiator schools, the professional instructors would train the students. There were 7 main classes of gladiators, distinguished by the weapons that they used or their method of fighting. For example, the retiarius, the netman, wore a short apron, some padding on his right arm, a protective mini shield on his right shoulder, and a throwing net in the right hand. Or the secutor had a shield in the left hand, a padded left chin and right arm, and a long knife in the right hand. And so on, through the 7 different specialist categories. So what about the myths? Well, first, many gladiators were slaves, but some were free men. They were attracted by the money and the lifestyle, for example, the favours of society women, and they were not put off by the 1 in 9 death rate. Second, it would have been too exhausting for the gladiators to be continually fighting. On average, they fought only 2 or 3 times each year. And if they were slaves, and if they survived long enough in the arena, they could sometimes earn their freedom. Third, the bouts were definitely not undisciplined free-for-alls. The gladiators were carefully matched into pairs from their 7 categories, taking into account the attack and defence weapons they carried and the strength and skill of each individual. So the retiarius, the netman, would be usually paired off against the secutor, the sword-wielding pursuer. Like modern Western boxers, who observe the Marcus of Queensberry rules, gladiators had their own very brutal and very strict rules, which 2 referees would enforce. Gladiator bouts were more like a sophisticated entertainment version of martial arts. They were closer to modern choreographed TV wrestling than wild melees.
This is the problem. Take a pair of scales of...
For most people, the word gladiator brings to mind either Russell Crowe as Maximus or Kirk Douglas as Spartacus. And so most of us believe that gladiators were prisoners of war or criminals who were on the road continuously fighting in wild free-for-all melees. And most of us think that all gladiator bouts finished with at least one of them dying. Now, these beliefs have, like all successful myths, some nuggets of truth. but they are basically wrong. The word gladiator means swordsman in Latin, and it comes from gladius, which means sword. At the very beginning, the gladiators fought to the death at Etruscan funerals to be bodyguards for the deceased person in the next world. Later on, Roman entrepreneurs recognized an opportunity and changed the emphasis from furnishing funeral attendance to providing entertainment. And so, gladiatorial fixtures took off in Rome and spread throughout the empire. The first documented gladiator bout in 264 BC had just three pairs of gladiators. But 3.5 centuries later, in 107 AD, the Emperor Trajan celebrated a triumph with 5,000 pairs of gladiators in the arena. 50,000 people would crowd into the Colosseum to enjoy the sport, junk food, and merchandise. Yes, the spectators could buy special souvenir glass cups embossed with the names of their favourite gladiators. Gladiatorial bouts finished early in the 5th century for a few reasons, including the opposition of Christians and the great costs involved. In the gladiator schools, the professional instructors would train the students. There were 7 main classes of gladiators, distinguished by the weapons that they used or their method of fighting. For example, the retiarius, the netman, wore a short apron, some padding on his right arm, a protective mini shield on his right shoulder, and a throwing net in the right hand. Or the secutor had a shield in the left hand, a padded left chin and right arm, and a long knife in the right hand. And so on, through the 7 different specialist categories. So what about the myths? Well, first, many gladiators were slaves, but some were free men. They were attracted by the money and the lifestyle, for example, the favours of society women, and they were not put off by the 1 in 9 death rate. Second, it would have been too exhausting for the gladiators to be continually fighting. On average, they fought only 2 or 3 times each year. And if they were slaves, and if they survived long enough in the arena, they could sometimes earn their freedom. Third, the bouts were definitely not undisciplined free-for-alls. The gladiators were carefully matched into pairs from their 7 categories, taking into account the attack and defence weapons they carried and the strength and skill of each individual. So the retiarius, the netman, would be usually paired off against the secutor, the sword-wielding pursuer. Like modern Western boxers, who observe the Marcus of Queensberry rules, gladiators had their own very brutal and very strict rules, which 2 referees would enforce. Gladiator bouts were more like a sophisticated entertainment version of martial arts. They were closer to modern choreographed TV wrestling than wild melees.
Task 4. You are going to listen to a recording about the Metropolitan Museum of Art. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 27 to 34 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Hi, I'm Carrie Barrett, a curator of American paintings and sculpture in the American wing at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I want to tell you a little bit about one of my favorite paintings in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and one that has to be among the sort of top 10 tourist attractions in the museum, if not in the city. The painting I'm talking about is Washington Crossing the Delaware by Emanuel Leutze, painted in 1851 in Germany. The scene that's shown is obvious. It's Washington crossing the Delaware in a boat with a great number of his troops. The actual number was 2,500. 2,500 men crossed the Delaware with Washington as their leading commander on Christmas night, December 25th, 1776. They crossed the Delaware River, Washington's battalion, about 9 miles above Trenton, New Jersey, and this is between the Pennsylvania-New Jersey border, on Christmas night during a nor'easter, one of the most violent storms that hits the northeast coast, if maybe some of our listeners have actually been through such a thing. It might surprise viewers of the painting to see such incredible ice, but because the Delaware River ran south, there was ice, big, huge ice chunks that flowed. The troops were, at this point, absolutely demoralized, debilitated by winter. You can only imagine how cold it was on that night. And it was sort of a last gasp in Washington's command to revitalize the creation of the United States, the war that was about to be lost after a series of humiliating and in tremendous defeats by the British over the Americans. This crossing of the Delaware was an absolute act of desperation. The way that Leutze depicts Washington as the key to the hierarchy, let's say he stands in the boat, which a lot of people think is sort of awkward, but might have been true. These were flat-bottom boats, and some of the men, in order to fit in the boats, did have to stand. Washington led a single battalion of officers across the Delaware with horses, you can see in the background of the painting, in separate boats. They had to be a different kind of carrier to go across the water. And Henry Knox, in a separate boat, the chief of artillery, whose voice, you might, if you look at the painting hard enough, you can almost hear his big, loud voice, you know, booming across the river the night that they crossed. Another interesting fact as you look at the painting is to think of the equipment, the clothing supply that George Washington's sort of ragtag militia would have had as provisions that fall and winter. Each man was given 2 linen shirts, 2 overalls, a leather or woolen waistcoat, that's a vest, with sleeves, breeches, 1 hat, 2 pairs of socks, and 2 pairs of shoes. By winter, most of the shoes had been destroyed. Some of the men in these boats had no shoes at all, making this very, very cold strategic enterprise all the more amazing. The painting, as I mentioned earlier, was executed in Germany, in Leutze's Düsseldorf studio. The figure of Washington, of course, Washington was gone by then, and Washington never went to Germany. Washington barely got out of the North Coast. He went to Barbados. It's the only place Washington ever went. He never went to Germany. He used studio mates and friends. You may see a tinge of sort of Germanic heritage in some of the faces on the men. That's no surprise, as most of the models for the various people in the boat would have been Leutze's German friends at the time. The actual model for Washington himself was the American painter Worthington Wittridge, a great landscape painter whose works you can see in other galleries here at the Metropolitan Museum. He used for Washington's head the life mask that was cast by Jean-Antoine Houdon at the end of the 18th century, the most accurate depiction of Washington as it was an actual cast of his face. And Leutze got the uniform from the Smithsonian. George Washington's military uniform had been donated to the Smithsonian Institution. So for the figure of Washington, he had a lot of good, very detailed information to go on. He chose to portray the American flag, although, you know, we love to point out the inaccuracies, giving Leutze the benefit of the doubt. He tried as hard as he could to make this as accurate as possible. Hi, I'm Carrie Barrett, a curator of American paintings and sculpture in the American Wing at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I want to tell you a little bit about one of my favorite paintings in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and one that has to be among the sort of top 10 tourist attractions in the museum, if not in the city. The painting I'm talking about is Washington Crossing the Delaware by Emanuel Leutze, painted in 1851 in Germany. The scene that's shown is obvious. It's Washington crossing the Delaware in a boat with a great number of his troops. The actual number was 2,500. 2,500 men crossed the Delaware with Washington as their leading commander on Christmas night, December 25th, 1776. They crossed the Delaware River, Washington's battalion, about 9 miles above Trenton, New Jersey, and this is between the Pennsylvania-New Jersey border, on Christmas night during a nor'easter, one of the most violent storms that hits the northeast coast, if maybe some of our listeners have actually been through such a thing. It might surprise viewers of the painting to see such incredible ice, but because the Delaware River ran south, there was ice, big, huge ice chunks that flowed. The troops were, at this point, absolutely demoralized, debilitated by winter. You can only imagine how cold it was on that night. And it was sort of a last gasp in Washington's command to revitalize the creation of the United States, the war that was about to be lost after a series of humiliating and in tremendous defeats by the British over the Americans. This crossing of the Delaware was an absolute act of desperation. The way that Leutze depicts Washington as the key to the hierarchy, let's say he stands in the boat, which a lot of people think is sort of awkward, but might have been true. These were flat-bottom boats, and some of the men, in order to fit in the boats, did have to stand. Washington led a single battalion of officers across the Delaware with horses. You can see in the background of the painting in separate boats. They had to be a different kind of carrier to go across the water. And Henry Knox, in a separate boat, the chief of artillery, whose voice you might, if you look at the painting hard enough, you can almost hear his big, loud voice, you know, booming across the river the night that they crossed. Another interesting fact as you look at the painting is to think of the equipment, the clothing supply that George Washington's sort of ragtag militia would have had as provisions that fall and winter. Each man was given 2 linen shirts, 2 overalls, a leather or woolen waistcoat, that's a vest, with sleeves, breeches, 1 hat, 2 pairs of socks, and 2 pairs of shoes. By winter, most of the shoes had been destroyed. Some of the men in these boats had no shoes at all, making this very, very cold strategic enterprise all the more amazing. The painting, as I mentioned earlier, was executed in Germany, in Leutze's Düsseldorf studio. The figure of Washington, of course, Washington was gone by then, and Washington never went to Germany. Washington barely got out of the North Coast. He went to Barbados. It's the only place Washington ever went. He never went to Germany. He used studio mates and friends. You may see a tinge of sort of Germanic heritage in some of the faces on the men. That's no surprise, as most of the models for the various people in the boat would have been Leutze's German friends at the time. The actual model for Washington himself was the American painter Worthington Wittridge, a great landscape painter whose works you can see in other galleries here at the Metropolitan Museum. He used for Washington's head the life mask that was cast by Jean-Antoine Houdon at the end of the 18th century, the most accurate depiction of Washington as it was an actual cast of his face. And Leutze got the uniform from the Smithsonian. George Washington's military uniform had been donated to the Smithsonian Institution. So for the figure of Washington, he had a lot of good, very detailed information to go on. He chose to portray the American flag, although, you know, we love to point out the inaccuracies, giving Leutze the benefit of the doubt. He tried as hard as he could to make this as accurate as possible.
This is the end of the listening test.